You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 13th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness. Also on the program today, guess that birth control deal did not satisfy the bishops. Do we all have to go now and do penance? I gotta check on that. Bank bailout, the implications of which become more clear, although apparently, I think, as of now, the document still doesn't exist. There's no real deal, just what we've been reported to believe is the deal. Europe on fire as we speak. Riots in Greece, in Belgium, in Portugal. Firefighters in Belgian firefighters turned their hoses on the cops at the end of last week. I guess there was another Republican primary or something. Something happened this weekend with the Republican race. Mitt Romney got even closer to losing the whole thing, I think, even though he won by one point, if you, you know, are willing to accept the fact that they shut out a huge part of Ron Paul's supporters. But we'll get into that as the program goes on. President Obama releasing his 2013 budget today, none of which will pass. None of his. But the interesting where he's going, at least from a rhetorical standpoint, wealthiest Americans will now, well, I should say he's proposing the wealthiest Americans will now not get a discount on their taxes for dividends. In other words, take this, Mitt Romney. We will dig into that a little bit later. And an interesting piece in the New York Times basically outlining how the most virulent anti-government payout and social safety net opponents also, statistically speaking and anecdotally, tend to be the ones who are taking the most from the government. I guess that doesn't come as a big surprise. And Anonymous over the weekend basically says they're going after the state of the nation of Israel. We'll dig into that as well. And a story that I know will make Jimmy Reefercake very happy about how pot's becoming a cash crop for cities and municipalities and some states across the country as they begin to tax medical marijuana. That's the first step, folks. Start getting some of that cash. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Some statistics that you may sort of intuitively be aware of, but the specifics are pretty stunning. We'll be right back with that.
And he increases the number of clocks by exactly one. Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Some people say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes, got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same. There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything.
Anything, anything.
Had a dream last night, but I forget what it was.
What it was, what it was.
Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Had a dream last night about you, my friend.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Michelle Alexander. She is an associate professor of law at Ohio State and author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness. Welcome to the program, Michelle.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Thank you. And your book I've been reading, I guess it's been out for about 4 or 5 months now. And maybe more. I can't remember. But give us just some of the statistics that you are dealing with in your book as to what leads you to the conclusion that the drug war in particular, but the amount in which the prison industrial complex plays in essentially creating a new set of Jim Crow laws.
Well, I fully recognize that, you know, on the one hand, with the election of, you know, Barack Obama as our nation's first black president, it can seem inconceivable, nearly laughable, to say that something like a Jim Crow system could be alive and well in America today. But the reality is that the majority of black men in major urban areas today are either under correctional control or saddled with criminal records for life. And once you're labeled a felon or a criminal, you're relegated to a permanent second-class status for life. You may be stripped of the right to vote, deemed ineligible for jury service, and legally discriminated against in employment, housing, access to education, and public benefits. So many of the old forms of discrimination that we supposedly left behind during the Jim Crow era are suddenly legal again once you've been branded a felon. Now, of course, the popular colorblind explanation for the explosion in black imprisonment in recent years has been crime and crime rates. But as I describe in the book in some detail, crime rates don't even begin to explain the explosion, the phenomenal explosion in black incarceration. It's due largely not to drastic changes in crime or crime rates, but instead a war, the war on drugs. Drug convictions have increased more than 1,000% since the drug war began. And even though studies have consistently shown now for decades that, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites, in some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been one race, have been African Americans. So through the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement, we've created this vast new racial undercast with literally millions of people cycling in and out of the prison system, locked out of the legal economy, often barred even from public housing, frequently denied even food stamps as a result of criminal convictions, due largely to a drug war that has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color.
So break down, and when we talk about the drug war, this was in fact started under the Reagan administration, I think around 82 or 83. As a white teenager growing up, the drug war, from my perspective, was just say no. And it was all about, PSAs on TV and some sort of like increased social pressure to not engage in drugs. But it's a completely different experience, I think. And I don't know if it was just at that time, but I mean, certainly I have a sense of it as it grew through the 90s, that as a black teenager, the drug war meant that if you live particularly in an urban environment, you're getting stopped multiple times a day just walking around.
Yes, yeah, so you're absolutely right. You know, during the early years of the drug war, it manifested itself mainly as sort of a public education initiative in middle-class white communities, but it was an all-out war in poor communities of color. And, you know, very often when I find that when I'm speaking about the drug war, people are going to say, oh, the drug war, wasn't that back in the 80s or the 90s? People don't seem to realize that the drug war is raging right now in poor communities of color across America. In fact, you know, the New York Police Department reported just recently that in 1 year alone, in 2010, the New York Police Department stopped and frisked 600,000 people. 600,000 people in New York Police Department in 1 year. More than 85% of those stops and frisks were of African Americans and Latinos. And in less than 15% of those stops and frisks, was there any kind of suspect description or investigation into a criminal case? These were hundreds of thousands of people being stopped and frisked on their way to school, on their way to the subway, on their way to the corner store. Just an extraordinary level of police surveillance and routine harassment that goes on day after day as a matter of routine in poor communities of color, leading to these astonishing rates of arrests and convictions for primarily nonviolent and drug-related offenses. I mean, to get a sense of how large a contribution the drug war has made to mass incarceration, has made to the quintupling of our prison population, consider this. Today, there are more people in prisons and jails today just for drug offenses than were incarcerated for all reasons in 1980. So we've had this explosion of imprisonment driven not by, you know, a Get Tough movement aimed at, you know, the most violent offenders or cracking down the most heinous crimes. No, we've been sweeping people into the criminal justice system by the millions for these nonviolent drug-related offenses. In fact, in the 1990s, the period of the greatest escalation of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession. You know, a drug less harmful, less addictive than alcohol or tobacco, and at least, if not more prevalent in middle-class white communities and on college campuses as it is in the hood. But by waging this drug war almost exclusively in the hood, we've created a situation today where there's more African-American adults under correctional control in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. The scale of this system of mass incarceration is just astonishing, and yet, you know, we don't hear much about it.
Well, there's two aspects to it. There's the incarceration aspect, and then sort of the implications of being a released felon, I guess, or an ex-felon. Or an ex-convict, in how it plays into the sort of the diminishment of rights and then sort of the diminishment of political power to change a system that is problematic. But looking at the system itself, what are the factors that are that sort of contributed to the building of this system and its perpetuation? I mean, I assume there are political factors that it benefited certain political groups or political agendas, and then there was sort of an alignment of interests with private corporations that are now making just a killing off of creating more prisons and housing the subjects of this drug war. So walk us through that, at how historically at different times there have been maybe different interests that have sort of folded into sort of perpetuating the system.
Yes. Well, you know, if you look back to really the origins of the war on drugs, you know, you can begin, I think, by taking a look at President Richard Nixon, who coined the term a war on drugs. But it was President Ronald Reagan who really turned that rhetorical war into a literal one. Reagan declared the current drug war in 1982 at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. It was before, not after, you know, crack hit the streets and inner city communities and became a media sensation. So why did the Reagan administration declare a drug war when drug crime was actually on the decline and the public wasn't too much concerned about drugs as a threat to the nation? Well, you know, from the beginning, the drug war had relatively little to do with genuine concern about drug addiction and drug abuse, and a great deal to do with politics, racial politics. Numerous historians and political scientists have now documented quite well that the war on drugs was part of a grand Republican Party strategy of using racially coded get tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare to try to appeal to poor and working class whites, particularly in the South, who were anxious about, fearful of, resentful of many of the gains of African Americans in the civil rights movement. And pollsters and political strategists found that these thinly veiled promises to get tough on them, a group not so subtly defined by race, could be enormously successful in persuading poor and working class whites to defect from the Democratic New Deal coalition in the South and join the Republican Party in droves. And as the strategy of promising to get tough on issues of crime and welfare and racially charged and racially coded rhetoric proved so successful, soon Democrats began competing with Republicans to prove they could be even tougher on them. And so it was President Bill Clinton who really escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican predecessors dreamed possible, in large part in an effort to win back those so-called white swing voters, the folks who had defected from the Democratic Party in the wake of the civil rights movement. And so you see that politicians across the political spectrum saw that this racially charged rhetoric of getting tough could be enormously successful in mobilizing poor and working class white voters. And so it became a bipartisan adventure, proving who could be tougher. But once mass incarceration really got going and our prisons and jails not only began to fill, but it became necessary to build more and more prisons, soon corporate interests saw that they could really make a killing off mass incarceration. So you see the birth of these private prison companies, which are now listed on the New York Stock Exchange and quite profitable even in a time of economic recession. And you see corporations ranging from phone companies to taser gun manufacturers and private healthcare providers all discovering that they can make a great deal of money off of mass incarceration. And so now there's this whole range of, you know, interests, private interests, as well as political interests that are deeply invested in this system of mass incarceration, which is one of the reasons why I don't believe we will ever see an end to mass incarceration in America without some kind of major social movement. The system's now just too deeply rooted, too deeply, you know, entrenched in our political and economic system for it to just fade away without some kind of major upheaval.
All right. Well, let's talk about the legacy, or just, I mean, there is no, it's tough to find a natural constituency here to sort of attack this system, right? I mean, on one hand, there's been studies, I guess, out as early or as late as 2007, which show that these private prisons don't save at the states any monies. And so perhaps there's a way of at least sort of disentangling the private interest from the interest of creating more prisons. But like you say, that's hard to imagine. There's also a growing movement to fight the drug war, I think, in this country. I just mentioned a story about how there's municipalities across the country that are making money off of medical marijuana taxation. So there may be some. But what are the factors, before we get to those factors, what are the factors that inhibit sort of this story from coming out and from this story changing? Because there is, it's very tough because there's no natural consistency, constituency to fight against it, because to a large extent, a lot of those people are sort of have firsthand knowledge of this problem, have been stripped of their rights to vote.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, the very folks who are most impacted by this system are the folks who are most demonized in our society, discredited, and often disenfranchised. So, you know, really building a movement to end the drug war and to end the system of mass incarceration is enormously challenging. In fact, one of the reasons why I decided to write the book in the first place was because I was becoming increasingly concerned about the failure of civil rights organizations to prioritize mass incarceration and to treat mass incarceration as a major racial justice issue, given the devastation that the drug war and the system was causing to poor communities of color. Now, fortunately, there has been some change in that regard. The NAACP has recently, come out in opposition to the war on drugs, and under Ben Jealous' leadership, there's much more attention being paid to the crisis caused to communities of color by mass incarceration. So there are some positive signs, but, you know, as I describe in the book, you know, one of the reasons civil rights advocates have been so reluctant to really take on these issues in an aggressive way is because throughout our nation's history, one of the primary strategies employed by racial justice advocates has been to distance themselves from those thought to be criminals and to identify those African Americans who defy racial stereotypes and who are considered to be of great moral virtue and to hold them up as symbols in racial justice campaigns. For example, Rosa Parks is an excellent example of, you know, trying to identify folks who, you know, the white majority will sympathize with, empathize with, and to use them as symbols of in racial justice campaigns as a means of helping to illustrate the, you know, injustice of the prevailing system of racial control. Well, that's not so easy to do when the system that you're trying to challenge is one that criminalizes large numbers of people. And so, you know, even in my own work, when I was at the ACLU working as a civil rights lawyer, we would challenge racial profiling tactics by law enforcement, but most frequently we would, you know, use as named plaintiffs, you know, people who had just returned from serving in the Iraq War and, you know, were stopped and searched and had their car dismantled, or hardworking teachers or doctors or lawyers who were stopped and frisked and, you know, subject to brutality for no reason other than their race. Very rarely were young folks who, you know, may have a criminal record featured. Kids who, you know, are stopped and frisked repeatedly because they have baggy pants or, you know, hang with the wrong crowd. And it's their voices, I think, that have got to be heard. We're going to have to learn to actually care about poor folks in ghetto communities if we are ever going to end this drug war and this system of mass incarceration.
Yeah, I want to ask you about, you know, I have in my notes, and forgive me, I can't tell from my notes whether or not I read this in your book or if I had seen it in an interview, but you speak of a story of of when you sort of had your moment where you realized sort of a specific aspect of this problem, when you had a potential client come in who had been documenting how he had been, I guess, being harassed by the police or pulled over, and the case was looking very good to you until you realized that he was a felon and he had claimed that that in fact he had been framed. Could you just tell us about that? Because I had the story to me sort of illustrates the problem almost twice over. But just tell us that story if you could.
Yes, well, you know, as when I was directing the Racial Justice Project for the ACLU in California, we had launched a big campaign against racial profiling. We called it the Driving While Black or Brown campaign and the DWB campaign. But we were also challenging stop and frisk tactics in a number of major cities. And we were interested in suing the Oakland Police Department. We'd already sued the California Highway Patrol for racial profiling in their drug interdiction program, but we were looking to sue other departments as well. And we had set up a hotline number for people to call if they believe they had been stopped or targeted by the police on the basis of race. And in fact, within a few minutes of the hotline being announced on the evening news, we received thousands of calls and our system crashed temporarily. But I was spending my afternoon, you know, one day interviewing one young black man after another who had been stopped, frisked, searched, often brutalized for no apparent reason other than race. And this young man, he's about 19 years old, young African-American man, had a very compelling story describing a pattern of police stops he'd experienced in his neighborhood over a 9-month period of time. He had actually taken notes of these incidents. He had names of officers, badge numbers in some cases, witnesses, descriptions of the incidents. And his story was corroborated by what we had heard that was going on in his neighborhood. And so I was very excited about using him as a name plaintiff. He was well-spoken, a good-looking young man. And as we were talking, he said something that made me realize that he was a felon. I said, you know, did you just say you're a drug felon? And he said, yeah, I'm a drug felon. But look, you know, the police planted drugs on me and they framed me and they beat up me and my friend. And he starts telling me this long story about how he was framed by the police and drugs were planted on him. And I just shut him down. I just said, I'm sorry, but there's no way I can represent you if you have a felony record. You know, the media will be all over us, and of course the police should be keeping an eye on him, should be stopping him. He's a drug felon. We can't put you on the stand without you being cross-examined, you know, about your prior criminal history in front of the jury, and then the jury is just going to view you as a criminal and isn't going to listen to what you have to say. I'm so sorry, but we just can't represent you. And he became enraged, and he just exploded at me saying, you're no better than the police. You're no better than the police. The minute I tell you I'm a felon, you just stop listening. You can't even hear what I have to say. He's like, what's to become of me? You know, I can't get a job anywhere because of my felony record. I don't even have anywhere to sleep. I'm sleeping in my grandma's basement because even public housing won't take me in. He's like, I can't even get food stamps to feed myself because of my drug felony. He's like, good luck finding one young black man in my neighborhood, you know, that they haven't gotten to yet. They've gotten to us already. And he leaves my office yelling, you're no better than the police. You know, you're just like them. I can't believe I trusted you. And to make a long story short, many months later, I come to discover that he had been telling the truth. The Oakland Riders police scandal broke, and it turned out that a gang of police officers, otherwise known as a drug task force, had been planting drugs on suspects and beating folks up, and the officer he had identified to me as having planted drugs on him was one of the main officers charged in the scandal. And it was really in that moment that I finally began to have my awakening and realized he was right about me. You know, the minute he told me he was a felon, I stopped listening. I couldn't even hear what he had to say. But ultimately, I came to see that my real crime wasn't in refusing to represent an innocent man. My real crime was allowing so many of the stories of people who've been stopped, frisked, brutalized, criminalized, believing those stories aren't worthy of being told, that those people can't be heard, that their voices ought to be silenced. in the pursuit of racial justice. And I started to see how I, as a civil rights lawyer, was actually replicating the very forms of discrimination, marginalization, exclusion that I was supposedly fighting against. And so that's kind of really the beginning of my journey in coming to see how critically important it is for us to start listening to those stories, start hearing from the folks who've been locked up and locked out, and you know, for those of us who claim to care, to start taking these issues more seriously.
I mean, well, I'm struck. I mean, that by that, that, I mean, it's an amazing story, and I'm struck by the sort of the challenge that even that story tells, because, you know, the transition for you happens when you realize the guy was in fact framed, but the problem is much bigger than people who are framed. It is that we have a system that is disproportionate in terms of its response to essentially minor drug possession crimes, and it's disproportionate. It's disproportionate in its punishment, and it's also disproportionate in terms of who pays those prices. And you know, I don't know when that program started out in California, the driving, but a long time ago, I worked in sitcoms. And I still remember that, and the listeners of this program will remember this story, but I worked on essentially an all black sitcom, and was hanging out with guys who were, not quite stars, but were doing very well. And the stories they would tell of driving around, I think the car of the day at that time was like a Range Rover in Hollywood. The stories they would tell of just being randomly pulled over were just so out of my experience as a white actor in Hollywood, and also so impossible for me to imagine being able to deal with, because that if that happens to me twice, basically I'm incapable of doing nothing else other than trying to fix that situation. But it was a situation that people would deal with on a regular basis. They were trying to get stickers for their cars to say, I own this car. And certainly, I was engaged in no less illicit activity when it came to drug possession than any of the guys I was working with. Let me put it that way. And so how does a movement like this begin to deal with that problem of people just feel to have that icky feeling about felons, you know, despite the fact that they may have engaged in the exact same behavior that led to a conviction for someone else or an arrest for somebody else?
Well, I think that's the key, is to help people to see that there is no, you know, us versus them. That the criminals, the boogeyman of our imagination, are not those aren't by and large the folks who are populating our prisons and jails and cycling in and out today. For the most part, they're folks who have committed the same kinds of mistakes that we all have in our lives. Most Americans violate drug laws in their lifetime. You know, most do. Barack Obama himself, President Obama, has admitted to using marijuana, you know, and cocaine, quite a bit of it in his youth. And if he hadn't been raised in Hawaii, if he hadn't attended predominantly white, you know, colleges and universities and engaged in his drug use there, if he had been raised in the hood, he would have been stopped, he would have been frisked, he would have been searched, and he might not even have the right to vote today, much less be president of the United States. He might be cycling in and out of prison and jails, you know, with the rest of them. So rather than having all the shame and contempt for the criminals, those who we imagine to populate our prisons and jails, we need to have an attitude of there but for the grace of God go I. You know, so many of us in our youth and some of us in our adulthood have made mistakes that could have landed us in prison. And in fact, you know, people will say to me, well, don't call me a criminal. I'm not a criminal. I say, okay, well, maybe you never drank underage, or maybe you never experimented with drugs. But the worst thing you've done in your whole life is spent speed 10 miles over the speed limit on a freeway. You've put yourself and others at more risk of harm than someone smoking marijuana in the privacy of their living room, but there are people in the United States doing life sentences for first-time drug offenses. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld life sentences for a young man on a first-time drug offense, saying that it didn't violate the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishments, even though virtually no other country in the world does such a thing, impose life imprisonment for a first-time drug offense. So I think this idea that the criminals are them, not us, is something that really needs to be challenged and for us to recognize. We all make mistakes in our lives. We're all sinners. We're all criminals to some degree or another. But only some of us are paying for our mistakes for the rest of our lives.
All right. And lastly, you know, I appreciate your hanging on with us this long. But last week, I think it was on Dylan Radigan's show, I saw a guy, David Kennedy, who is a criminologist who has this sort of plan to go into cities and go to hotspots where there's crime and sit down. And I've read in the past that he doesn't perceive a racial bias. And I think you mentioned him in the book. Just give me your sense of like what the perspective of people who don't see this as a racial, you know, either in, I mean, they don't see it as a, I don't know if they don't see it as a racial issue or they don't see the racial bias that goes into the, sort of the outcomes or the inputs. Just give me your perspective on how people could be looking at this and not perceive that. Is it simply a question of, the micro decisions may not be racist, but there's a broader sort of alignment of interest that ended up the outcomes being sort of racially, I guess, driven?
Well, I think, you know, there's a number of levels to this. You know, people often say, you know, is this motivated by conscious bias or is it just unconscious stereotyping? How much of it is intentional? How much of it is an accident that we wound up, you know, with millions of poor people of color cycling through our, you know, criminal justice system. And, you know, I think there's a range of motivations that, you know, help to explain how we got where we are today. I certainly don't believe that all police officers or prosecutors are bigots in kind of the old Jim Crow sense at all. No, I think, though, that we can all agree that if young white kids were being stopped and frisked and searched in the way that young black kids are as a matter of routine today, and if police officers were fanning out on college campuses and sweeping dorm rooms as a matter of routine, saddling, you know, young white kids with criminal records, felony records that would follow them for the rest of their lives and make it impossible for them to get employment and housing or even qualify for food stamps, that there would be this enormous uproar. It would be viewed as obviously unfair and immoral, but we care less. We care less about folks in ghetto communities. It's easier to imagine the worst possible things about them and to be relatively blind and indifferent to their experience and to rationalize it in various ways. I think there's no doubt that politicians in the 1970s and the early 80s deliberately exploited our nation's racial divisions and anxieties for political gain. And they set into motion a war mentality where some of us were the enemy. And who that enemy was and what that enemy looked like was defined largely in racial terms. And therefore, many well-meaning officers who were just trying to do their job thought that what it meant to do their job was to stop and frisk and search as many folks in those communities, the enemy territory, as possible. And, you know, that doesn't mean they're all bad, but it does mean that we've created a system that is doing an incredible amount of harm. And as Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. used to, you know, remind his audiences very frequently, you know, racial caste systems like slavery and Jim Crow don't depend on hostility and the evil bigots to survive. What they depend upon is indifference, turning a blind eye by people who ought to know better, and denial, and you know, the rationalizations, even by those who claim to care. So that, I think, is where we are today. We have a system that came into being for a wide range of motivations, but is now deeply entrenched. And those of us who claim to care ought to do far more to bring the system to an end.
Michelle Alexander, the book is The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks, we need to take a break. And that break will lead us into the better half of the program. You can support this show by becoming a member at majority.fm. As always, we need your support. Soon, maybe we'll institute some type of pledge drive or something to that effect. But if you're listening for free on iTunes, please go give us a review. You don't have to write much. You just put a couple of stars down. It helps the program. Also, we have a survey that will be embedded in the, or at least the link will be found in the today's show post at majority.fm. If you have some time, please fill out the survey. It will help us perhaps get some advertising. I promise this will be the second to last survey I ask you to fill out this year. Also, you can support this program. If you buy junk through Amazon, you can buy it through our link on the support the show page at majority.fm. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, 10% coupon code. Use the word majority, get 10% off. It's great coffee. Don't make the mistake of not getting it. And of course, we have merch. Where else are you going to find a 30-minute interview with that author? Maybe one or two other places, but I can't imagine what they are. In the better half of the program, all right, let me put it this way. Where else can you find an interview with an author like that for 30 minutes, then followed up with me making fun of a hilarious video of Andrew Breitbart being a crazy person?
That is nowhere else.
Nowhere else. Let's put it that way. We got the high load, the high road covered, and the low road. That probably should be the name of the podcast. High Road and the Low Road. And in Breitbart's case, maybe even like the subterranean road. Like the one that's underground. All right, folks. See you in the better half. You can call me 646-257-3920 or IM me at Majority FM. See you in the better half.